Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. For the entire month of January, we are discussing solutions to our many problems, and today we are focusing on the climate crisis. We have 12 years to drastically cut greenhouse gas emissions. According to the United Nations, if we don't, the extreme weather events that we are already seeing and experiencing will continue to get worse. So what are actual solutions to this crisis? We know we need to get to 100% renewable energy. The question is, how do we get there? Soon after the election, incoming New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez proposed a Green New Deal, which would transition the U.S. to 100% clean energy. Over the next decade, the Green New Deal would create clean energy jobs and infrastructure in a fair and equitable way. According to the Sunrise Movement, the millennial-led group that pressures politicians to make climate change a top priority, 45 members of Congress support a select committee for a Green New Deal. The committee would conduct hearings and write up legislation by March of 2020. And one of those supporters is Congresswoman Jackie Speier. She represents the 14th District here in California, which includes most of San Mateo County and a portion of San Francisco. We have about 15 minutes with Congresswoman Speier, so if you have any questions for her about how politicians plan to deal with the climate crisis, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And unfortunately, we're having some internet connection problems, so giving us a call would be the best way to get in touch. 866-798-8255. Congressman Woman Speier, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Rose.
It's great to have you. So why did you decide to put your support behind the Green New Deal? What does it mean to you?
I really think that this issue supersedes every other issue that we are dealing with on the planet today. And I think Congress has got to take this issue much more seriously. Unfortunately, we have in the president and the administration this group of deniers that can't take science on at its face value and continues to do so many actions that are absolutely the reverse of what we need to be doing. So it's alarming to see what's happening in the Department of Interior and the Environmental Protection Agency, because it is wrong-headed and going the wrong way. We need to recognize that we have to undertake this issue like the Manhattan Project of old, where a number of countries came together, put all of their brain trust together to find the solutions. We know what some of the solutions are. We don't know what all the solutions are, but we've got to make a commitment. Certainly the Paris Accord was a step in the right direction. Unfortunately, the president has rebuked that. The good news is that, of course, it doesn't go into effect until 2020, and hopefully we'll have a new president by then.
As you said, we do know what we need to do in terms of, you know, renewable energy. I mean, there's still a lot of things and a lot of science that we don't know, but there's a lot of settled science out there. And I'm wondering, who are you all consulting when it comes to these questions about what to actually do? What scientists are you talking to? What academics are you talking with about how to actually solve and tackle this crisis?
Well, there are so many of them that you can, you know, handpick a select group to be, you know, your particular advisors. But, you know, the steps that we have to take are pretty obvious. And what's interesting is that, you know, corporate America, as bad as it is from time to time, recognizes it as well. You have United Airlines saying that they're going to be using renewable energy and biofuel for all of their planes within the next 20 years. Now, if they're doing that volitionally, imagine what they would be willing to do if we impose some requirements in that regard. I have a lot of companies in my district turning algae into jet fuel. And it's being promoted by our Department of Defense. So even though we have an administration that are full of deniers, the underlying elements recognize that it's a national security issue not to deal with this. So I look at my district, it's ground zero for sea level rise. In the next 40 to 60 years, it's a $39 billion cost that we will incur if we don't address it now. So we're looking at ways of creating an assessment district so levees could be built all over the district to protect the land.
Congresswoman Speer, one of the big issues around the Green New Deal is a select committee, because obviously with Republicans controlling the Senate, climate deniers in the Senate, and then oil and gas really calling the shots for the Trump White House, we're not going to get any legislation unless Democrats win back the Senate and the White House in 2020. So what activists and young people are calling for is a select committee which would have the power to draft legislation. And I think this is a new idea for a lot of people learning about how all of these committees work. Mm-hmm. And last week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced the formation of a new select committee on the climate crisis. It'll be headed by Florida Congressmember Kathy Castor. Now, can you give us the facts around this? Because, you know, a number of activists are saying that they're upset with this decision. They believe that this committee is much weaker than what the backers of the Green New Deal had envisioned, because it will not have subpoena power or the power to draft legislation. Is that right?
So it doesn't have subpoena power. That doesn't mean they can't request all of the oil and gas executives to come and testify. And the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee has indicated that he would subpoena them if they do not volitionally come forward. So I think it is not in the precise description that the backers of the Green New Deal had recommended, but in terms of putting a focus, an intense focus on the issue, and coming up with recommendations that can be translated into legislation, that is something that will clearly be within the purview of the committee and something that we should all be very excited about. I mean, we're basically putting the gauntlet down against all of those climate deniers and saying we are going to take action here. So it's not precisely what they want, but it is going to have the same effect.
What would you say to the activists? They're also upset because they want to ensure that the people who sit on the committee do not take money from oil and gas executives or any lobbyists tied to the oil and gas industry.
Well, I think that's a good principle generally. I don't take money from oil and gas executives or their PACs, so I'm sure that many members don't as well. It's not a new idea. It's been a concern that many of us have had for a long time. So the activists are drawing attention to one of the issue areas, but it's not going to, I think, cause any concerns for those who are going to be crafting the legislation. And, you don't have to be on that committee to draft a bill. You don't have to be on that committee to draft a specific bill to deal with climate change that would be taken up by the Energy and Commerce Committee. So I think that there is much ado about nothing here. To the activists' credit, they made a big pitch about creating a select committee on the Green New Deal. There is a committee. It may not be as they had specifically proposed, but it will have the same impact.
Congresswoman Jackie Speer represents the 14th District here in California, and she is one of the 45 members of Congress who supports a select committee for a Green New Deal. Congresswoman Speer, we have Isaac Silk in studio with us, and he is with the Sunrise Movement's Bay Area chapter. As you know, Congresswoman, this is the millennial group that really pressures politicians to make climate change a priority. Isaac, what do you think about Congresswoman Speer's comments that this is really much ado about nothing? This committee is going to do the work that it takes to come up with some kind of legislation to be ready to go at the end of 2020.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously Sunrise is disappointed that the select committee was not the version that we envisioned. And what we were really hoping for is a mandate to create a plan that would radically transform a lot of different sectors of our economy off of fossil fuels within the next 10 to 12 years. At the moment, the committee does not have that specific mandate. So it's up to Kathy Castor to really prove that that's what they're going to do, and that will make folks in the activist community and beyond extremely happy. So the proof is in the pudding. It's easy enough to call the climate crisis a crisis in the name of the committee. It's a different thing to actually treat it as such and put forward legislation that's going to have the effect that we're hoping for, which would be to stop global warming.
Congresswoman Speer, what about that mandate?
So, you know, I think Isaac should take credit for drawing attention to the need for a select committee and actually achieving that. I think that we're on the right track. You know, I have the same, I think, sense of urgency that Isaac is speaking about. And I think that it's important for the activists to stay on us so that we move as swiftly as possible. But I actually have great confidence in Congresswoman Kathy Castor. I know her well. She's very smart, very talented. And I think she's going to do the right thing.
And last question, Congresswoman Speer, I know we have to let you go. We are also going to be joined today by Greg Carlock. He is Green New Deal Research Director at Data for Progress. And really, the report they put together is so incredible and so ambitious. I mean, we're talking about 100% clean and renewable electricity by 2035, zero waste by 2040, which when you look at how wasteful this country is an amazing thing to think about. 100% fossil-free transportation by 2050. Congresswoman Speer, we are really focusing on solutions and how to get there. What would you say are some of the top, like the three policy changes or priorities on your list?
So I think we've got to get serious about a carbon tax, carbon recapture, and putting aside enough financial resources so communities around the country, and there are many that are going to be dealing with sea level rise, are going to be in a position to protect homes in the regions.
And on another note, since we have you just quickly, you and California Congressman Jared Huffman were picking up trash at Land's End in San Francisco on Saturday because of the government shutdown. Do you have any updates on this? I mean, it's amazing that it's gone on this long. We just talked last week about how so many government workers are living paycheck to paycheck and they're not able to pay their rent.
It's actually an embarrassment that this country, as great as we suggest that we are, would allow this president to shut down the government, now the longest shutdown that we've had in probably 40 years, over his petulant idea of wanting a wall. I mean, there are many people that do live paycheck to paycheck, as you point out, and they are government workers, and their stories are real. So I'm hopeful that over the course of this week, we will be able to reopen all of government. And, you know, when you start having TSA workers who are calling in sick, and you've got Border Patrol officers calling in sick, that's a national security. And that's what the president should be focused on, not the building of this very expensive and very ineffective wall.
Congresswoman Jackie Speer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Congresswoman Speer represents the 14th District here in California, which includes most of San Mateo County and a portion of San Francisco. She is one of 45 members of Congress who support a select committee for a Green New Deal. The idea behind the committee is that it would conduct hearings and write up legislation by next year. And joining me in studio to continue this conversation about actual solutions and what's in the Green New Deal is Isaac Silk. He's with the Sunrise Movement's Bay Area chapter. It's a millennial-led group created in 2017. It's a decentralized collection of hubs across the country. They conduct protests. I'm sure you saw them protesting in House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office. They also pressure politicians to make climate change a priority. Isaac, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Greg Carlock is Green New Deal Research Director at Data for Progress. Greg is lead author of an extensive policy report on a Green New Deal, which sets very clear goals and timelines for carbon reduction and job creation. Hi, Greg. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you, Greg. And thank you so much for putting this Green New Deal report together, because I really wanted to focus on actual solutions. And you all do a great job of laying those out in this report. Before we get to that, I wanted to get your comments about what Congresswoman Speer said about the Select Committee. She said that a lot of the concerns activists have are really much ado about nothing. She believes that they are going to do the hard work of possibly bringing in oil and gas executives, having them testify, and coming up with some kind of plan by the end of next year. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I consider it a bit of a bittersweet compromise. I second her endorsement of the efforts of the Sunrise Movement to draw attention to this, and I think that's the greatest win that we can at least take out of this, is that 2 months ago we didn't have a national stage for this kind of conversation. This is a space that I work in and have worked in for over a decade, and it's so great that it's on the agenda again. But I also understand the disappointment of a lot of folks who have been working on this that want a serious response to a serious problem and asked for very specifics for that response, and it fell a little bit short and could be underwhelming, and view how that may not result in the outcome that we're hoping. But that doesn't mean I'm not optimistic. I think that there can be conversations. There's a venue now in which we can raise these issues, bring in the research community, bring in the business community, bring in local governments and local bodies to organizations to speak about the solutions and the problems. And then that does not preclude, as the Congresswoman said, working through the existing committees to integrate climate change and policies and other energy policies and resilience policies into existing legislature.
And Isaac, just to be clear, basically this committee would conduct a number of hearings, so you could bring scientists in, you could bring in oil and gas executives. The reason why you all wanted subpoena power is because in order to get some of these guys, I think a lot of them are, I'm guessing 90% are men, although that is changing, you'd have to subpoena them to come into D.C. to testify. Right?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, the committee that used to exist 10 years ago, which Nancy Pelosi, to her credit, started in 2007, did have subpoena power. So the reasons for that change are still unclear to us. And actually, that committee is the one that put forward the cap and trade bill that never made it through the Senate. That's a long story, which we don't need to go through. Mm. But the fact of the matter is, the head of the Energy and Commerce Committee, Science, Space, and Technology, and Natural Resources have all agreed to hold climate change hearings as well. So clearly what we're doing is having an effect. One of the things about Congress is there are a lot of separate committees dealing with separate issues. A lot of them get touched by climate change, so there's not very much communication between the committees. That was the idea behind a Green New Deal, is that or a Green New Deal committee, is that you need to have a group that's working on something that can touch all of the different sectors that are affected by climate change.
What kind of hearings would you both like to see? Off the top of my head, it would be amazing to have executives from Exxon, Chevron, and BP and others come to the table and talk to them about what we now know that they knew decades ago about climate change. I mean, that would be an incredible hearing to have. What other hearings would you like to see, Isaac?
Well, I would like to get some people who are working on real solutions in there to talk about what we can actually do. Mm-hmm. I think that for too long we've been peddled false solutions, and people have been talking about solutions that are based in the not-so-real science of political feasibility as opposed to the real science of what climate change researchers are looking at. So we're talking about a transition that's based in scientific reality, and that needs to happen in the next 10 to 15 years. That means that politicians who are in office right now need to look at their kids, look at their grandkids, and say to themselves, do I want this to be a livable future for these kids? If so, I need to start acting in a real way right now.
Greg, what kind of hearings would you like to see?
Well, I want to definitely second what Isaac said, and speaking about the solutions. But some of the things that we've learned over the past 15 to 20 years on a lot of these solutions, and even more recently looking at what's happened in France, is that it has to also be understood how these solutions are going to impact communities. And so I think elevating the local voices, whether they're environmental and climate justice organizations or other community organizations, local governments, and have them convey the challenges that they have and the needs that they have to ensure that federal policy is really meeting frontline communities where they are, addressing the inequities, but in addition to finding the solutions, crafting the solutions that are going to make their life better and not make them bear the cost. And then the second thing I'll add is not boxing it into an environmental conversation, because I think core to the Green New Deal is that this is a symptom of an economic problem, and both pollution and exploitation of resources. And so considering a lot of the other environment economic elements that we include in a Green New Deal, and about how this is a job creator, how this can be an economic boon for communities, and don't forget the kind of lasting sustainability of our economy.
I'm glad you brought that up, because the Climate Justice Alliance recently put out a press release called "A Green New Deal Must Be Rooted in a Just Transition for Workers and Communities Most Impacted by Climate Change, Indigenous, African American, Latino Communities, Asian Pacific Islander, and Poor White Communities on the Front Lines of the Climate Crisis." And another hearing would be to bring on these people who are so directly connected by this. What about that? Can you talk more about that, Greg? Just ensuring that as we move forward, these communities are not only considered, but also have a seat at the table.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of ideas out there, and the Climate Justice Alliance and their partner organizations and their network are very equipped with that understanding. But it's not only bringing their voices to the table in both understanding the impacts and discussing the solutions, but making sure that the implementation of those solutions have their involvement as well. So whether there's kind of these local bodies or bodies at the federal level in different departments or agencies that oversee any implementation of this, involve their perspective. And then what that looks like on the ground is identifying where are the most vulnerable communities, where are the low-income and minority communities that have been hit hardest on this, how the solutions, and understanding both from a research side and an economic side about how these different solutions will impact them, and ensuring that you know, the benefits that come from a lot of this, whether this is through a carbon price, a tax and dividend, through increased regulation, are targeting those types of areas that have been hit a little bit harder historically.
Greg Carlock is Green New Deal Research Director at Data for Progress. He is the lead author of a policy report on a Green New Deal, which sets very clear goals and timelines for carbon reduction. We have a link to that report, and I hope you can take a look at it, because I just love what's in this report. You know, I feel like finally there's a long, long list. I know that a lot of groups have done this, but I think it's so important when we talk about the climate crisis. For example, I'm just going to read under energy efficiency, 100% net zero building energy standards by 2030. Transportation, 100% fossil free transportation by 2050. Clean air, national clean air attainment, cut methane leakage 50% by 2025. Clean water, national lead pipe replacement and infrastructure upgrades. So this lays out so many solutions to this crisis. We'll talk more about that after a break. We're also joined by Isaac Silk. Isaac is with the Sunrise Movement's Bay Area chapter. Today it's our One Planet series, and we are talking about solutions to the climate crisis. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We are going to focus specifically on solutions for the entire month of January. So tomorrow we will talk about what a national improved Medicare for All system would look like. Democrats have finally agreed to hold the first ever hearings on Medicare for All. And according to the Washington Post, between 58 and 70% of Americans support some form of Medicare for All. And I bet if the national media talked about it more, those numbers would go up. So we're going to talk about what this would actually look like. I hope you can join us for that. Today, we are talking about solutions to the climate crisis and the Green New Deal, which would transition the U.S. to 100% clean energy over the next decade or so. We're talking about it with Isaac Silk. He's with the Sunrise Movement's Bay Area chapter. They conduct protests and pressure politicians to make climate change a priority. We're also joined by Greg Carlock, Green New Deal Research Director at Data for Progress. Greg is the lead author of a policy report on a Green New Deal, which sets very clear goals and timelines for carbon reduction and job creation. And if you have any questions or comments about specific solutions, what solutions would you like to see? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email our internet connections back up at yourcall@kalw.org. All right, Isaac, when we talk specifically about solutions beyond individual solutions, because that gets a lot of attention and it's very important, but we need bold policy changes. So when you all get together at the Sunrise Movement, how are you coming up with these bold solutions?
Yeah, I think, you know, by and large, we leave the policy proposals to our friends like Greg, who are the experts and the policy quote-unquote wonks. But the main thing we're working with as young climate activists is trying to get folks in elected positions to take the issue seriously and offer up real plans. So for us, that looks like advocacy and really getting elected officials to take this seriously. Now, from my perspective, it also looks like energy democracy and encouraging policy changes in the way that energy is distributed. So I don't know if you heard the news today about the PG&E, but they're considering filing for bankruptcy, separating out their gas business from the electricity business. And here in the Bay Area, we're receiving our energy from local clean energy alliances, and that all is great. And that's the kind of future we're looking at, one where our energy is provided at the local level, and the profits from that are being reinvested in the community. That's an exciting solution for me. I think it also extends beyond just electricity. You're looking at the agriculture sector. Mm-hmm. How can we regenerate agriculture, start putting carbon back in the ground? I mean, it extends to forestry. There's so many different areas where there are policy solutions that we can look at. How do we make our oceans healthier? And that was one of the reasons we were so excited about this select committee, is that this climate change issue touches so many different aspects of our economy. It's not just an environmental issue, as Greg said. It has to do with the health and well-being of people living in corridors that are transporting coal, just right here in the Bay Area, Vallejo, Richmond, Oakland, and other areas. So, you know, solutions are all over the place. There's tons and tons of them. There's lots and lots of people working on them. Can we get Congress to actually take a look at those solutions and implement them?
Right. And Greg, to that point, that's such an obviously important part of the conversation. But I also think, you know, going beyond individual action and talking about some of these bold solutions, once you get those into the conversation, then you could put more pressure on the politicians. Because at this point, you know, whenever we do shows about climate change, you hear about biking more, eating less meat. I'm so glad that's getting more attention now. But what about the bold initiatives? That's what I don't hear from a lot of guests until we actually really push them. So you all did that with a Green New Deal report, a progressive vision for environmental sustainability and economic stability. Talk a little bit about how you all came up with this report. What really went into it?
Yeah, thanks. You know, it was about the summertime where, you know, everybody got everyone's attention was caught by then candidate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and was using this Green New Deal as part of her campaign platform. And it immediately resonated with me, just not only in my interest in American history and FDR and New Deal politics, but then, you know, the green aspect. So I kind of had an instant understanding of what was being conveyed through that. And she spoke a lot about green jobs and clean energy. But coming from my space, I knew that there's so much more to that. And I know that those who have supported it understand that there's a lot more to it. And running on, you know, 100% renewable is a slogan you hear a lot. It's a commitment you hear a lot, particularly ever since, as was mentioned, the Trump administration expressed their desire to back out of the Paris Agreement. A lot of local and state champions have put forth commitments. But I wanted to make sure that if this became a national conversation, that it really covered many more sectors than just energy and just green jobs, which are really important, are huge selling points to the benefits that this has for the American people and the American economy. But I wanted to cover that this included, you know, not just where we get our electricity, but also our vehicles, also our buildings, how we build our buildings, how we operate those buildings. That we don't forget about clean air and clean water is still not 100% accessible to Americans, to our communities, despite trying to, you know, protect those things over 40 years ago and expand infrastructure. We're still not there. We have a lot of restoration to do. As Isaac mentioned, we have to look to our forests as well as our wetlands. We have a lot of brown fields, which are kind of contaminated areas in and around communities that can't function. You wouldn't want to use those lands, but they can be restored and reclaimed. And we want to revitalize and bring economic activity back to communities around those spaces. And then we also can't forget about resilience. And I know that was already mentioned about that many communities are going to face a lot of climate impacts, whether that's sea level rise or flooding, extreme heat. That's going to affect agriculture as well. And so I really wanted to ensure that all of these areas were part of the conversation, if we ever got to this point, which now we are. But last thing is, as you said, I wanted to make sure that it was packaged in a way that there were pieces that people could communicate. So there's kind of, you know, three levels to this report. There's a Green New Deal and what that is and what those goals are. There's these kind of small, easily packaged goals where it says, I want to stand up behind this one. And then there's descriptions and illustrative lists of policies and investments that might work to approach those goals.
As you write in the report, a Green New Deal is more than just renewable energy or jobs programs. It's a transition to the 21st century economy. It's a holistic combination of solutions at every level, federal, state, and local, and addresses many problems simultaneously. It does this because it must. So let's dive in and talk about these. I love how you lay it out so clearly. You give a line, for example, clean and renewable energy, 100% clean and renewable electricity by 2035. All electricity consumed in the U.S. must be generated by renewable sources, including solar, wind, hydro, sustainable biomass, geothermal, and renewable natural gas, as well as clean sources such as nuclear and remaining fossil fuel with carbon capture. So this is one of the things. It sounds great, 100% clean and renewable electricity by 2035. But a lot of people can't really talk past that. You'll say solar, wind, but what does it actually look like on the ground?
Yeah, I think it's definitely an engineering question. There's a lot of people, a lot of colleagues that I have that look at this very closely, and which is why I wanted to at least kind of get all of these little pieces into the conversation, and then potentially through those hearings we can at least hear the engineers who can say, this is what it would look like, this is what it would do. You know, on the ground, and Isaac alluded to that a little bit, is starting with local generation, right? Creating these local microgrids where you are getting as much local generation around, whether that's local wind, a lot of distributed solar, geothermal, and supporting as much as you can, maybe battery storage as that gets to scale here over the next decade. And then going out from there to larger generating units from utilities that can supplement a lot of that, but also recognizing that within the engineering, there you know, cost is always an issue. You know, one of the things that I've heard a lot about with what I've written is the inclusion of things around natural gas and nuclear and carbon capture, and there's debate about those things, right? Because there's still concerns about extraction, even if natural gas, even with capture, even if we reduce, increase efficiency, there's still issues around the extraction and the transportation and what that does to communities, particularly out west or coming through Canada. And those are all valid concerns, and we have to figure out how we transition existing natural gas infrastructure to something. But that's going to take time to figure out how to engineer that. Similarly, with nuclear, that provides 20% of our power. That we can't just turn it off. That doesn't mean we don't turn it off. That's another engineering conversation about whether or not there's better ways to deal with the waste problem and the justice problems around communities that have to deal with that. But I think it looks a lot more like keeping what we have in terms of nuclear, addressing any economics around that, and then making a plan where we might have to deal with that anymore.
At least here in the Bay Area, and I know this is a problem in many parts of the country, more and more people are driving cars, and the highways are packed, the cities are packed. Under transportation, you're calling for 100% zero emission passenger vehicles by 2030. The thought of this is really amazing because that's only 12 years away. How do you see that playing out? As you write, the technologies already exist. We only need to scale up charging infrastructure and consumer incentives to transition 100% of sales to zero emission passenger and light duty vehicles by 2030.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to underscore there that, when we're talking about electric vehicles in this sense, we don't want to forget less automobile trips, right? That's a huge portion of this, and that there's, without getting too much into it, there are urban land use and transportation policies that also need to be part of this conversation about how do you reduce the number of trips overall, because that will have a huge effect. But anything that is moving, still moves, needs to be electrified. This is really looking at those trajectories that we were, those emission pathways that were alluded to earlier. We have 10 to 12 years to really cut, ideally 50% of national emissions, global emissions, but, this is our responsibility at home to cut national emissions. A pathway for transportation means that, within the next decade or so, we really need to not be selling internal combustion engines. That doesn't mean we transition all vehicles. This is really about the sales and ramping up performance standards, fuel economy, and tailpipe emission standards, so that at least all those passenger vehicles are operating off electricity. And that really means communicating to folks how that affects their life or really doesn't affect their life, that it can be done, and it feels just like filling up a tank of gas. Most trips are less than 15 miles, and you can get to where you need to go and plug in where you need to plug in. But there is a culture change there that we'll need to address to get to that scale.
100% fossil-free transportation by 2050. To reach decarbonization goals, we must transition away quickly from the use of fossil fuels in aviation, heavy-duty vehicles, and rail. Not everything can be electrified, meaning we must innovate and scale up the next generation of biofuels and carbon-neutral fuels. And I'm reading here from Greg Carlock's policy report on a Green New Deal. He's the lead author. He's a Green New Deal research director at Data for Progress. We're also joined by Isaac Silk with the Sunrise Movement's Bay Area chapter. They conduct protests and pressure politicians to make climate change a priority at the local, state, and national levels. And today we're talking about solutions to the climate crisis and what a potential Green New Deal would look like. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for this. I appreciate what's going on. I'm going to check this out further. But I want to give you an example of what I think is really something that's contradicted by this report. And that is, I live in Palo Alto. There's been massive development down here over the past 5 or 10 years, and it's going to continue. Right now in the city, there are two huge projects planned, which are going to cover hundreds of thousands of square feet of parking garage and a police headquarters for emergency services. And instead of solarizing the city, I mean, this money could have been spent in better ways. And also Stanford is undergoing huge development. But instead of these two entities, Stanford...
Oh. Did we lose you, Greg? Oh, all right. Sorry for that noise. We got the gist of your question, Greg. I think that at the end of the day, Isaac, you're all focusing not just on the federal level, but also the local level, because everything we're laying out here has to happen at all local, state, and national.
Totally.
And we're talking about major shifts.
Absolutely. And I know that Palo Alto has a sustainable development plan. All of the cities in the Bay Area have plans for how to address climate change. Now, whether or not the staff of those cities are given the resources that allow them to implement the solutions that the city itself has said it wants to do, that's a different question, right? So the developers need to be told by government that they are not allowed to develop in the way that they currently are. Now, how that gets paid for, that's why we're talking about a Green New Deal, right? We don't see a massive transformation of the entire economy just because the city of Palo Alto decides that that's what's going to happen. Now, the city of Palo Alto can advocate up through levels of government. It can partner with other cities. It can tell the state of California it needs help doing this kind of development. But none of us can do this on our own. And yeah, the caller, Greg, is right. This issue is so huge. It touches so many different things. And one of those things here in the Bay Area is the development and the housing crisis here. I mean, it goes back to the equity issue when you talk about transportation. Our friends that live far away from the city center here, they are going to be massively affected if gas prices go up, and they need assistance in electrifying their vehicles and getting into the city in order to make money using electricity. So there's a huge problem here, and that's why we need assistance at all levels of government to make this an equitable and just transition for people who had no part in creating this problem.
Well, exactly. And when you think about the Bay Area, so many people are being pushed out of cities, and unfortunately, we need better public transportation for the Bay Area. You know, I like BART and Muni, but in many cases, it doesn't get people to where they need to go. And it's also expensive for people who need to make ends meet. So as you said, and I think it's so important that we focus on this, through no fault of their own, people are being pushed away. They have to drive longer to get to work, and they don't have any alternatives but to drive a car.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the very reason we're seeing the protests in France, right? The Yellow Jackets are fighting back because the tax there was essentially regressive. And the, you know, any sort of solution to this problem needs to also incorporate solutions for people who are on the ground facing real problems as a result. So that's why we're talking about making sure that there's a job guarantee in any sort of legislation that's passed, because we want to make sure that our friends who are getting transitioned out of coal mining jobs or out of other jobs in the fossil fuel industries are given opportunities to work in the future. Their pensions are protected. We want to make sure that people whose lives are affected by the transition we know needs to happen on a moral and a scientific level are helped out in that transition and made sure that their lives are still possible.
Greg, you have an entire section in your report, A Green New Deal Achieves Job Growth in Three Ways. And you write that the goal is to create 10 million new jobs over the first 10 years through employment and training programs associated with Green New Deal grants and projects. And these are jobs that pay a livable wage. This is a green job guarantee. This is such an important part of the plan. Can you talk more about this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've actually been told by a couple economists that that's probably a lowball estimate. So that's a good thing if that's true. But you know, the Green New Deal, just like the original New Deal, is by its very nature an economic stimulus. And give some credit to Naomi Klein for pointing that out for everybody. And therefore, there's an opportunity for a lot of economic growth and job creation. And we want to make sure that such a program establishes not only the different sectors in which job growth can be possible, but redefine really what a decent job means. So that's whether that's through job standards and or job guarantee or through workplace or workforce development and job trainings. So you know, in terms of implementing the solutions, that could mean hiring people. But for in terms of a just transition, that means traditional historical fossil fuel industries and folks that need to be retrained have the opportunity for some unemployment benefits while they are take on a new profession. And make sure that they're moving into a new field that, or anybody contributing to these fields associated with these programs, get a new livable wage job, right? So that's the job guarantee really is about you can almost think about it as a public option for unemployment, and ensuring that any such job has a livable wage, has benefits, has health care, has collective bargaining, to the extent that that's a factor. And it really is to contrast what folks are facing right now in the private sector. What I hear a lot is that, you know, unemployment's so low, it seems a little bit of a weird time to be talking about a jobs program. But if you look at the job quality and the ability for folks to make a living or absorb a sudden cost, that's really declined, and wage growth has really stagnated over decades. And so I think that that's where we're looking to redefine what it means to have a good job through this.
As you point out in the report, solar jobs have grown 168% over the past 7 years, and wind turbine technicians, that's one of the fastest growing jobs in the U.S.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a new fields of energy, and the thing about distributed energy is that it means you can kind of put it anywhere, and that means a lot of states, a lot of communities, and a lot of congressional districts. There's a lot of opportunities for green energy jobs, but there's other areas of what a green job could mean. It could be dealing with waste. So that's solid waste or wastewater treatment. It could be dealing with the landscape restoration. It could be dealing with transport and the construction and the manufacturing for all of these industries. So when you look closely, there's a lot of opportunities to support this 21st century economy that we're describing, and making sure that a lot of the workers that contribute to that are getting a larger slice of the pie than they've been given in the past.
We have just a couple more minutes. I want to ask you about one more element of the report, and then Isaac, we'll ask you about how people can get involved in all of this. The zero waste by 2040, that one stopped me in my tracks, because we do so many shows about plastic, about just over the holidays, all of the online shopping just continues to increase. Mill Valley said that over the holidays, they had about 6,000 packages going through the post office every single day. And yeah, a lot of that stuff can be recycled, but it's overwhelming the system. So can you give us just a few details? I just love this idea of zero waste by 2040. How would that play out?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question at a national scale. There's a lot of folks who advocate for zero waste, and there's a lot of firms, a lot of companies that take on a zero waste policy. But at a national scale, at a government level, I think it'd be really interesting to explore of what that looks like and what policies are necessary. I should say that, you know, zero waste does not mean no waste, right? It's about exploiting every opportunity to turn waste into a resource, because that's essentially what waste is. But it's not going to be without some of these cultural changes around consumption, and what we do with waste, whether that's sorting it, and it getting into our ecosystems. But there's a lot, I think, that can be done in dealing with some of the major types of waste where we have plastic use. Single-use plastic is definitely, I don't want to use the word fad, but I'm glad it's a fad, right? And I think a lot of companies are trying to get rid of single-use plastics out of their processes. But also packaging and the useless, necessary, unnecessary, redundant packaging that just gets thrown out and can't be recycled. But then, as you said, you got to do something. Even with the waste that we create, even if it's 100% recyclable, communities need to figure out how to handle all that waste and access markets where that waste can go. And I think there's a role for governments to play to create those markets and make those incentives so that those materials are put back into the system, are designed and processed from, you know, cradle to cradle, as they say, to be much more of a circular process.
Well, Isaac, at the end of the day, we need political will to get so much of this done. And again, the idea behind the Select Committee for the Green New Deal is to hold hearings over the next year and a half to ensure that Democrats are on the same page with a piece of bold legislation that could be introduced if the Democrats keep the House, take back the Senate, and win the White House. How can people get involved in really pushing politicians at all levels of government to get on board with this?
Yeah, I think when I talk to local elected officials and we talk to electeds in general, they don't feel the public really cares about this issue in the way that they need to see in order to make it a priority.
They say that.
That is something that elected officials have said to me here in the Bay Area.
Huh.
And I'm assuming that it's the way that federal elected officials feel as well. If you look at the polls, if you look at the fact that in 2016 there was not a single question asked about climate change in the debates between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Now, we need to change that. That is basically the only pathway forward we have for a livable future, basically to avoid the collapse of civilization within the lifetime of people that are alive today. So what does that look like? That looks like talking to politicians and your elected officials, getting involved in local politics, going to your congresspeople's offices, getting engaged with them. And it also looks like joining local groups. I mean, we're talking about a solution that integrates citizens' opinions and local control over things. So get involved with the group, talk to your elected officials, and get informed on the science. Tell your friends.
And pressure the media to cover this, because not asking one question about climate change is just – it's – shocking, really, that that question was not asked during the presidential debates. That has to change this time around.
And we will change it.
Yes, you will. Isaac Silk is with the Sunrise Movement's Bay Area chapter. They conduct protests and pressure politicians to make climate change a priority. Thank you for all of your work, Isaac. Thanks for coming in. Greg Carlock is Green New Deal Research Director at Data for Progress. He's the lead author of an in-depth policy report on a Green New Deal, which sets very clear goals and timelines. And I hope you can check it out, yourcallradio.org. Greg, thank you, and thank you for your work.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for listening. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Thanks to Andrew Stelzer for producing today's show and Shipra Shukla for line producing. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call's One Planet.